This is Friday, December 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Ira Melman in Washington. Coming your way today, the U.S. president vows to retaliate against Russian hacking.
We need to take action, and we will, at a time and place of our own choosing.
Also ahead, thousands trapped as the evacuation of residents from Aleppo, Syria is suspended. And we examine what lies ahead for U.S. relations with China and a breaking story from China. All on today's International Edition. President Barack Obama says the United States will take action against Russia or any other foreign government that tries to meddle in U.S. elections. Speaking during an interview with U.S. broadcaster National Public Radio at the White House, Obama said Russia's apparent actions demand a U.S. reaction.
I think there is no doubt that when any foreign government tries to impact the integrity of our elections, that we need to take action, and we will, at a time and place of our own choosing. Some of it may be explicit and publicized, some of it may not be. But Mr. Putin is well aware of my feelings about this because I spoke to him directly about it. And there is among the big powers, there has been a traditional understanding of that everybody's trying to gather intelligence on everybody else. It's no secret that Russian intelligence officers or Chinese or, for that matter, Israeli or British or other intelligence agencies, that their job is to get insight into the workings of other countries that they're not reading in the newspapers every day. There's a difference between that and the kind of malicious cyber attacks that steal trade secrets or engage in industrial espionage, something that we've seen the Chinese do. And there's a difference between that and activating intelligence in a way that's designed to influence elections. So we have been working hard to make sure that what we do is proportional, that what we do is meaningful.
Joining us from the White House now is VOA's Aru Pandey. Aru, the president is most likely going to talk more about this later today. What's expected from him?
That's correct. I'm sure this issue is going to dominate the press conference. It's dominated the headlines between the White House and Donald Trump, at least the last few days. During yesterday's White House press briefing, we heard the press secretary, Josh Earnest, hit out at Trump and Trump's camp, basically saying that Donald Trump knew about this hack, just like everyone else did before the election, and that he should support this investigation. We've been down this road before, the United States and Russia, whether it be their behavior in Ukraine, whether their behavior in Syria, and the president has always said that there are consequences. And what would those consequences look like? Well, the United States could increase sanctions on Russia, but then you also have to look at the time frame. There's only a few weeks left in the Obama presidency, and if Donald Trump enters, when Donald Trump enters the White House, there's some concern that he could reverse any such sanctions. And then, of course, there are other options, including cyber warfare. So it's expected that he will touch on what the response might look like. I'm sure he's not going to go into detail because he's said that it will not be public. But it is something that will dominate the news cycle as it has, and obviously the press conference today.
For those people who really haven't been following this minutely, the Trump on the incoming Trump transition team and Donald Trump himself has played down this entire intelligence report, saying that Russia has played a big part, and the CIA report saying that it could even be Vladimir Putin. However, the Obama administration has been very strong in its anti-Russian moves of late. Can you explain that a little bit?
Well, obviously, I mean, the biggest thing that came yesterday was a tweet that Donald Trump, the president-elect, he tweeted out yesterday, if Russia or some other entity was hacking, why did the White House wait so long to act? Why did they only complain after Hillary lost? And that, again, the White House has said, we didn't wait to act. U.S. intelligence knew about this. The U.S. intelligence community put out a very strongly worded statement in October, basically saying that, you know, this hack was orchestrated at the highest levels, you know, among senior officials in Russia. And, you know, we haven't heard much from Donald Trump on this. He's questioning whether Russia was behind this attack, why this is coming up now. And that's what we've been hearing between the two, the White House saying, look, Donald Trump knew about this. His campaign knew about this. He even joked about this. And the fact that, you know, he's saying now that, you know, this is something we're bringing up after the election as if to delegitimize the results, that's ridiculous. So, and that's another reason why many said, why didn't the Obama administration act, you know, if we knew this was going on in July, in the fall, in October, before the election, why didn't President Obama say something then? Why weren't there actions taken then? And basically, White House officials have told some of these news outlets that, you know, the administration didn't respond more forcefully before the election because they actually thought, you know, Hillary Clinton was going to win, and they didn't want it to appear that the White House is interfering in the election. Obviously, Donald Trump, you know, during the campaign said that the vote will be rigged, and so they didn't want to feed into that. And obviously, they also, President Obama has said, like, he does not want to get into a huge cyber war with Russia, and that can be detrimental, you know, obviously to Russia, but also to the United States, whose economy is so dependent on the Internet. So there's a lot that's been going on. I think what the White House is saying, and you'll hear President Obama say, is that President-elect Trump should support a thorough review and investigation into the Russia hack, should acknowledge that this hack happened, and that, yes, it did, in fact, help his campaign and hurt Hillary Clinton's.
Well, it gets more interesting every day, doesn't it?
Yes, it does.
VOA's Aro Ponte joining us from the White House. Thanks so much, Aro.
Thank you.
International Edition continues as Andrew Palshevsky has joined us with his social media report. And Hillary Clinton had something to say about this whole hacking thing last night, did she not? And that's coming up on social media?
Yeah, she did. She was at a party to thank her campaign staff and some donors. And she said at that party that her theory is that Vladimir Putin used his grudge against her to direct some of the hacking. Now, this is making waves on social media. Some people saying that, of course, it's, you know, his meddling and they're continuing to push for further investigation into this. But some are saying she's just making excuses for why she lost and she should just give it up because she is not the president. So the back and forth continues even after the election is over. Of course, the Russian hacking was a big story in the election, but so was the fake news on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media sites.
Boy, there's a transition if I ever heard one. Look at that.
Hey, there we go. But, you know, fake news still causing a lot of consternation on social media. So Facebook has announced that they are going to have a multi-pronged plan to combat fake news. Now, there are roughly three steps. First, Facebook is going to partner with third-party fact-checkers, some mainstream media sources, and Poynter's International Fact-Checking Network to look into the stories and verify them. Second, they're going to give users an option to report fake news in the way that they can report harassment or things that are objectionable. And third, if a story is determined to be fake, they're going to mark it as disputed by the third-party fact-checkers. Now, this caused a little bit of debate on social media and even in our newsroom about whether that's a good or bad thing. The pro side of that is that it's going to be a meaningful step to identify what's fake. But the con side is that some of these websites, fake news websites, might see that as a badge of honor that the mainstream media is going against them, saying, look, they're saying we're liars, but we're telling the truth. And it might actually feed into their narrative.
Fill me in on something. So who adjudicates this? The world at large or what?
Well, this is the interesting thing that Facebook in recent months has been moving towards kind of more of an editorial, almost a journalistic role. They've talked about how they're kind of almost like a news organization. But now they're using a third-party source, using the Poynter Institute's fact-checking network, which is made up of a bunch of different news organizations. So they're kind of outsourcing that verification from their own shop. So it looks like they're maybe moving away from some of the editorializing and trying to give that to some actual journalists.
Now, this is just Facebook. This is not being taken up as yet anyway by any other platforms, right?
No, just Facebook so far. But Facebook was really the one platform that saw the most of this fake news happen and most of it spread. So they're by far the biggest, and that's why they're probably the first.
Well, you can communicate with Andrew Palaszewski. I'm talking to him. You can write to him. How do they do that?
You can find me on Twitter at APAL, and they can find you on Twitter at VOA Mailman.
Thank you for telling me that on a weekly basis. I
always
greatly appreciate
happy to help,
it.
My friend.
This is International Edition from VOA. Among our top stories, the evacuation of residents from Aleppo, Syria has been suspended, leaving thousands trapped. We'll hear more about that in just a moment. President Obama says the United States will take action against Russia or any other foreign government that tries to meddle in U.S. elections. Donald Trump, the U.S. president-elect, has nominated a controversial figure to become the country's next ambassador to Israel. The Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe and Russian President Vladimir Putin and 2 days of talks without any significant breakthrough on their major issue that divides them, a territorial dispute that dates back to World War II. Expanded coverage of these stories and more on the VOAnews.com website and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition.
This is Science in a Minute.
The UN's World Meteorological Society says the biggest wave ever to be measured by a buoy was identified at 0600 Universal Time on February 4, 2013. The colossal 19-meter swell was spotted in the North Atlantic Ocean between Iceland and the UK. The previous highest wave recorded by a buoy was measured at over 18 meters on December 8, 2007, also in the North Atlantic. Wave-measuring buoys are part of an extensive international observational network, which also includes ships and satellite observations to keep an eye on the oceans and make forecasts for weather-related hazards. While this wave was the highest measured by a buoy, it's certainly not the biggest overall. A nearly 31-meter high wave in Alaska generated by an earthquake set the records back in 1958. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
The worrying part for us at the moment is that there are still...
This is International Edition from the Voice of America. I'm Ira Melman. The evacuation of people from Aleppo has been suspended, leaving thousands of people trapped. Blasts were heard Friday near convoys moving people out of the city. State media report rebels have violated the ceasefire agreement with the government, but rebels say it's not true. It's not clear when the evacuations will resume or even if they will. Addressing a UN news briefing in Geneva via telephone, World Health Organization representative Elizabeth Hoth said Red Cross and UN officials were informed to leave the area. I've spoken a very scratchy telephone line from Aleppo. Hopefully we have this for you.
The worrying part for us at the moment is that there are still in the besieged enclaves of East Aleppo, the remaining besieged enclave where we have had the evacuations going on. There are still high numbers of women and infants, children under five that need to get out. They have been collecting on collecting themselves on the point where the buses and the ambulances were waiting for them. But now with the operation aborted, they would have to go back to their houses. And this is a great concern to us because we know that they are desperate to get out.
Well, convoys of ambulances and buses pulled away Thursday from Aleppo, which was a crown jewel of Muslim and Arab history and culture before the Syrian civil war turned it into one huge ruin. Buses left eastern Aleppo, went into government-held territory before eventually taking it to another rebel-held part of the province. Russia's president said Friday his country is working with Turkey to start a new round of peace talks on Syria with a goal of a nationwide ceasefire. Vladimir Putin, who, as you know, is in Japan, said he and Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan propose holding negotiations between the Syrian government and the opposition, possibly to take place in Kazakhstan's capital of Astana. His comments came as more civilians prepared to leave the destroyed city after thousands of people did flee on Thursday. Joining us in our Washington studio is VOA State Department correspondent Steve Herman. Steve, what so far has been the U.S. reaction to this latest occurrence in Aleppo, if there indeed there has been any?
Well, for days, the United States and the State Department have been increasingly warning of a very dire situation and still hoping that there can be a diplomatic solution to this entire debacle. Secretary of State Kerry has accused Syria's government of carrying out, quote, something nothing short of a massacre in Aleppo. There's also a lot of activity at the United Nations. And just a few minutes ago, UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon urged Syria to resume the evacuation, saying, quote, Aleppo is now a synonym for hell.
Well, as you well know, and everybody just about well knows, the upcoming transition from the Obama to the Trump administration, is that going to play any part in how the current Secretary of State Kerry plays in this scenario in Syria and at all?
The assertion from Kerry and from all of his top aides until the very last day, the very last moment, they are going to be engaged on this, that they're going to follow the policies of this administration and try to press for a diplomatic solution. The one thing and the only thing, Ira, that the United States and Syria agree on here is that even with the fall of Aleppo, it's not going to be the end of war.
No, and I think that's been said even in an interview yesterday that Al-Assad did with Russian television in English, and then he went outside and he claimed victory, saying it was the best thing that's ever happened to Syria since ancient times. I guess he wasn't expecting to happen what did happen.
Well, there's been practically a total victory now by the Syrian forces in Aleppo. But on the other hand, they have now lost Palmyra. And Islamic State has again seized that area and seized some weaponry, which the United States Defense Department said earlier today that they've bombed, including some anti-aircraft batteries. So he may claim that, you know, this is a great victory and he's taking the country back, but no one is seeing any sort of military solution to this, perhaps except Assad. And both the Russians, the United States, and other countries have said, look, no matter what's going on, we still have to press for diplomacy to try to solve this.
Now, we have a breaking story here that's just come across over the last half hour or so, and that deals with a U.S. submersible vehicle and China. Tell us what's going on here.
Yes. What we know, and information's a little bit scratchy, is that a Chinese Navy warship seized off of Subic Bay in the Philippines a what's called an oceanographic survey ship. It's an unmanned underwater vehicle belonging to the U.S. Navy. It came off a ship called the Bowditch, and the United States contends that this is a sovereign immune vessel, clearly marked in English, not to be removed from the water, saying that it's U.S. property. Of course, China claims a big swath of the South China Sea as its own. The State Department is telling us they're not going to comment on this. They're referring us to the Defense Department, but what we're hearing,
which is interesting unto itself, right?
Right. Yeah. But we are hearing that a demarche, a formal diplomatic claim, has been filed by the United States with the Chinese demanding the return of this device. The United States is saying that this drone, underwater drone, is part of an unclassified program to collect oceanographic data. But of course, things that move around deep under the seas can be used for other things, for all sorts of classified monitoring. And it may be some time before we know exactly what has gone on with this.
Now, just to get this straight, China does claim this part of the South China Sea or off of Subic Bay, or we're not sure yet?
I'm not exactly sure the exact spot, but obviously the Chinese are going to contend that this vessel was in a place that it shouldn't be without permission of the Chinese.
Well, this had been predicted. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yes. Obviously, as I reported yesterday, the Chinese on the disputed islands and the Spratlys have been building them up with weaponry, which at this point still appears defensive, anti-aircraft and anti-missile systems. Those are now placed on all seven of the artificial islands that China have built in the South China Sea. And so this coming on the heels of all that activity just further ramps up the tensions. And today we know that U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry has spoken with his presumptive successor, Rex Tillerson, and congratulated him. But we don't know if that Kerry said anything to him about, you know, we really need to talk to you and brief you about what's going on with the Chinese.
Well, our State Department correspondent, Steve Herman, has just called home and told everybody that he will not be home on time because of this breaking story. But have yourself a great weekend. Stay warm. It's very cold here in Washington. And thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you, Ira.
Steve Herman, this is VOA.
VOA Special English, a way to learn American English and much more. Broadcasting a half hour of world news and features every day on radio. You can also find Special English on television and online at voaspecialenglish.com for 50 years, helping people understand world events and the language and culture of America.
Well, that's going to wrap up our program for today. This is International Edition. Find us at voanews.com, like us on Facebook at VOA Now, and follow us on Twitter at VOA_IE. Thanks again for joining us. My thanks and your thanks as well to Director Patrice Martin, our engineer Cornelius Tinner. My name's Ira Melman. I'm in Washington. Have a great weekend. Enjoy your day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Much has changed in the 35 years since a terrible new disease, known today as HIV/AIDS, was identified. Before, an HIV/AIDS diagnosis was a death sentence. A person with HIV often lived less than a year after it progressed to AIDS. Today, nearly half of the 37 million people living with HIV/AIDS receive life-saving HIV treatment, allowing them normal lives. Through the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, the United States has been at the forefront of the global response. PEPFAR is the largest commitment by any nation to combat a single disease in history, said U.S. Global AIDS Coordinator Ambassador Deborah Birx. Recent data show the epidemic is becoming controlled in several key African countries, demonstrating the remarkable impact of PEPFAR's investments. Indeed, achieving an AIDS-free generation is now within our reach. Driven by research and data, our collective efforts have saved millions of lives and are turning the tide against HIV/AIDS, said USAID Administrator Gail Smith. Today, PEPFAR is supporting 11.5 million people globally with life-saving treatment. The good news is, according to a recent UNAIDS report, infections in children globally have dropped 51% between 2010 and 2015. Simultaneously, annual AIDS-related deaths fell from 2 to 1.11 million. The bad news is the virus is spreading among young women in sub-Saharan Africa. According to a recent UNAIDS report, last year nearly 1 in 5 new infections worldwide occurred in women between the ages of 15 and 24. Adolescent girls and young women account for nearly 75% of new HIV infections among adolescents in sub-Saharan Africa. This is concerning, as the 15 to 24-year-old population in sub-Saharan Africa will have doubled by 2020. There are many reasons for the alarming rates of new HIV infections among young women, including gender-based violence, exclusion from economic opportunities, insufficient access to health care, even a lack of access to secondary education. So, through PEPFAR, the United States is working with its partners to reduce, by the end of 2017, new HIV infections among adolescent girls and young women by 40% in the highest HIV burden areas of 10 sub-Saharan African countries. It's the first time the U.S. government has ever set specific targets for preventing new HIV infections among this group, underscoring the U.S. global strategy to empower adolescent girls. With our partners, we can sustain an enduring legacy of American leadership, compassion, and determination, said USAID Administrator Smith. Together, we can end AIDS worldwide by 2030.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.